Welcome back to Switchcast, pre-recorded special edition. That's right. We are not live tonight, but we have a very special guest in-house, Jay Roberts, who is a fellow cannonball historian, among other things. And tonight is a very special and interesting episode. We're going to start from the beginning of cannonball. That's right, all the way back to 1903, before it was even called cannonball. And we'll get into why it is called cannonball, and cover some of the really intriguing stories of the early transcontinental crossings and the records and kind of the three different eras of cannonball. So sit down, buckle your seatbelts, although when we started, they didn't have such things, and come along for the ride. It gets progressively faster in 120 years, but we're going to sum it up in about 120 minutes.
Hopefully.
Absolutely. So with that, I am your host, Doug Tabbitt, and Switchcast is the automotive-related podcast where we're searching for the truth and the humor in the car industry. Our goal is to educate, edify, and entertain you on the drive of your life. And cannonball certainly is the drive of anyone's life, as those who have done it can attest to it. What we are setting out to do in these couple of episodes, as it'll probably take us a few episodes, is to be as accurate as possible in covering the records over the entire 120 plus year period of transcontinental crossings. There's some information out there on Wikipedia, and of course we all know from Michael Scott how accurate Wikipedia can be.
Yes.
There's a couple of YouTube documentaries, which are actually quite good, but we're always discovering and uncovering new records and new information about the early records. A quick example of that is, for the longest time, and even according to a Hagerty post recently, 1933 is known as kind of the last record for a period of almost 40 years until Brock Yates resurrected the cannonball and ran in 1971. Well, we've uncovered three different records in between 1933 and 1971. So we're going to get into all that. And it's not going to be just a verbal Excel spreadsheet here. We've got stories, we've got anecdotes, we've done a lot of reading, and there's some really interesting stuff along the way. I want a special thanks to a few people in helping us compile this information. One is, of course, Ed Bullion and Vin Wiki for creating this list and compiling it. And, of course, a number of people have taken it and run with it and contributed to it, not the least of which would be John Ficarra, an automotive historian, Mason Dibley, and sitting beside me, Jay Roberts. There are many others as well, but I think those are some of the heavy hitters who have done a lot of the research and digging into the deeper history of some of the early turn of the century runs. Little bit of background on cannonball. So in the history, I've essentially divided cannonball up into three main periods. One would be the Baker era. So we get that name, of course, from Irwin George Baker, known as Cannonball Baker. He set 143 different endurance driving records over the course of his career. That's right, career. He did record drives for money. He was sponsored by manufacturers and tire companies. He had quite an incredible racing career, both in endurance racing and on racetracks and sanctioned
from motorcycles
racing,
to Indy 500s,
hill climbs, the whole shebang. So we'll get into a little bit of that, but that is where we get the name cannonball from him. So we're figuring the 1903 to 33 period is the cannonball era. And then, of course, we have the multi-vehicle races from 1971 to 1983. And those were immortalized in multiple movies, Gumball and Cannonball Run and Cannonball Run 2. Was it Gumball or Gumball Rally?
Gumball Rally.
Gumball Rally.
Well, anyway, I think it actually was named to both, depending on which region.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. So that was probably the most memorable and most well-known era. And then, of course, after 1983, there was nothing nothing again until 2006. And then we have the modern runs, most of which are solo runs. At least all of the outright records are individual vehicles going, similar to the Baker era. So we're going to start with the Baker era. And of course, we're going to get right into it. One of the most interesting runs is 1903. That was the first transcontinental crossing. And there was three transcontinental crossings that year.
Yes.
But Jay, you have uncovered the most significant one because it was the first and it was the fastest of those three.
Great.
Tell us about it.
Well, it's a gentleman by the name of George A. Wyman, and he drove a 1902 California motorbike. It's basically, it's a bicycle with a 200cc single-cylinder engine bolted to it for its power. Well,
I don't think I would want to drive that now, let alone 120 years ago.
Well, how would you feel about pedaling the last 150 miles of the run because the engine quit working?
Yeah, no. Pass.
That's exactly what he did.
So he ran from the West Coast to the East Coast, correct?
San Francisco to New York.
So over 3,000 miles.
It was over 3,800 miles.
Goodness gracious. That's some detours.
Yes.
The current route from New York to LA is about 2,800 miles.
Right.
So that's an extra 1,000 miles on a motorized bicycle.
Over half of the drive he did on railroad tracks because there were no roads.
That's incredible.
So, yeah, some of the crazy stories on his run, he broke down the crankshaft on the engine broke in Aurora, Illinois. He pedaled it to Chicago, and he ordered the part. He had to wait in Chicago for 5 days for the train to arrive with a new crankshaft.
So he could have done it quite a bit faster.
He could have. The route he took, he come across the Rocky Mountains, and he hit a snowstorm, and he couldn't pedal or motor through the pass that he was going through. He found an abandoned snow camp in the mountains, spent the night in the snow camp, and while he was there, he rigged up some straps to carry this 90-plus pound bicycle on his back.
How far did he carry it?
The first day he carried it was over 7 miles.
Holy moly.
This was in the Rockies, through the snow. Again, this is 1903. There were no roads. It was paths, cart paths, if that. He did that for 3 days. He carried this bicycle on his back for 3 days until he got to an area that was clear enough that he could crank the motor up or pedal down the other side of the Rocky Mountains.
This is like the Oregon Trail computer game on steroids.
Yes, he didn't get
like
dysentery.
If you literally smoked crack and then played the game, mm-hmm. That's what George Wyman did.
Exactly what he did. It took him 60 days.
50 days.
Excuse me, 51 days. To complete this journey. And well, what's interesting, after he got there, he was treated as a celebrity. This was the first motorized transcontinental crossing of the United States. And they put the car on display there in New York City at the recently formed
New York
New York Motorcycle Club. But he had to be carried by a wheelchair to a big party for the display because he was so wounded and so injured from the journey. His hands were in bandages. He spent 5 weeks in a hospital. 5 weeks recovering from this trip.
That's he spent almost as long in the hospital as he did on the bike.
He did. That's how much torture he put himself through
that's
to do
incredible.
This.
Incredible.
Well, then,
51 days.
While he was there in the hospital, have you ever heard of the organization FAM, F-A-M?
No.
And so the Federation of American
Motorcyclists. I mean, I've heard about it on TikTok. Because they're always saying, like, what's up, fam?
What's up, fam?
I think
no.
About that organization.
There's a whole different kind of fam.
Okay.
It was the Federation of American Motorcyclists, and they had a huge event to inaugurate their founding, and they invited him to that. Well, he showed up again, bandages on his hand, treated as a celebrity. The very next day, they put his California motorbike on a train and him on a train. He went back to San Francisco. That journey took him 6 days on a train.
On a train.
And they had a hero's welcome, so to speak, in San Francisco and put the bike on display. And by that time, the bandages were off his hands, and he was actually able to shake people's hands and thank him for, well, what he'd done.
That's cool. So, sidebar here, that actual bike will be on display September 14th at an event called Cars Are the Stars in Minerva, Ohio. And we'll publish some more information on that event soon, including where you can get tickets. But mark your calendars for September 14th in Minerva, Ohio, because we're actually going to have a visual display of the Cannonball Records for the last 120 years. So that California machine, that actual bike, will be on display along with other notable record cars throughout history all the way up to the current Cannonball Record car. So we will have
the beginning of the end.
The Fraud Taurus. Yeah. Well, unless somebody beats a record in between now and then that car will be there.
But will the Yates Gurney Ferrari be there?
We're working on that.
Okay.
We will have the bookends, and we're working on filling in the center. But it is an event you cannot miss. It will be an absolutely once
in a
lifetime.
Sounds like a significant historic gathering.
Absolutely. We are also working on a 1903 Winton. And the significance of that was the first car to cross. Now, they claimed to set the record for transcontinental crossing, but already we were getting into nuances because George Wyman was the fastest and the first.
Yes.
And as far as I see it, it's a vehicle. It's a motorized vehicle. That is an automobile. He was the first.
Correct.
So it took the Winton 64 days to cross. It was a two-cylinder Winton. It was Horatio Nelson Jackson, Sewell Crocker, and Bud the Bulldog.
That's right.
They took a dog along with them. So I guess they could claim, you know, the fastest canine record or something. But fastest four-wheel and four-paw record. But there's a lot more readily available information on that record out there, and that's widely held to be the first transcontinental crossing, but it wasn't. And even then, like I liken the nuance of a car versus a motorcycle, right? So if our current record got beat by a motorcycle, I wouldn't then say, well, we have the sedan record or whatever. I'd be like, no, we got freaking beat.
Yes,
like,
exactly.
It takes more strength, more chutzpah to do it on a motorcycle than it does in a car.
Way more.
So if anything, there's a handicap. So if you go faster in a vehicle in which there's a handicap, I'm not then going to like put an asterisk on mine or yours or whatever. No. I'm like, no, you went faster.
Well, you honor and recognize all the runs. And
absolutely.
If they beat you, they beat you.
Absolutely. So anyone does better in 25 hours on a Honda Moto Compacto, you win. You get the George Wyman Award and the record.
Yes, and the respect of cannonballers everywhere.
But it is still significant because it is the first car to cross the country. And they did it in 64 days, but then were beaten by 2 days later that summer in a Packard Model F driven by Tom Fetch and Marius Krupp.
Well, let's go back to the 1903 Winton.
Let's.
It's a two-cylinder engine, 20 horsepower. Guess how many gallons of fuel they used?
I haven't the faintest idea.
They used 800 gallons of gasoline.
Goodness gracious.
So
they would definitely get Brock Yates's Friend of the EPA Award in irony.
But what makes that even more difficult is in 1903, there were no gas stations. There were no roads, you know, and the only place you could purchase fuel was at pharmacies. Gasoline was sold by the half gallon or the gallon as a cleaning solution. It was sold as a carpet cleaner.
I was going to say, at pharmacies, gasoline then is, as it is now, it's considered a drug.
Correct.
That they're trying to make illegal.
It was.
Ironically. And anyway.
So they had to stop at enough pharmacies along the route to accumulate 800 gallons of gasoline.
Tell us about, we're skipping ahead in terms of how Baker did it.
Right.
That's a lot of stops.
But another interesting thing about that run is Mr. Jackson went broke during the run. He ran out of money. And he had to wire some friends in San Francisco to send him more money. In waiting for that wire to arrive, they continued to drive, and they went 36 hours without food.
Oh, my goodness.
36 hours without food. Because they were broke, they had no money.
I mean, I've done 36 hours without sleep on one run, but that's just
right.
36 hours
without food. But he spent that run in 1903, he spent personally, mostly due to loans, $8,000.
Wow.
That is $260,000 in today's money.
Goodness gracious. That's like an Alex Roy level run.
It is.
$8,000 it cost to make that run.
$8,000 in 1903.
That is incredible.
And, well, what's interesting, that entire run took place over a $50 bet.
I'd say that was a bad bet.
And he won the bet, but he was never reimbursed the $50.
Mm. It's incredible how there's so many stories of today's runs, like Richard Rawlings' run was over a bet.
Yes.
That all go back to the early days. Switchcast is brought to you by Boxcast. Boxcast is a live streaming company based in Cleveland, Ohio, and they serve broadcasters and viewers around the world. Their founders launched Boxcast back in 2013 with one purpose: to make people part of the experience. If you're looking to live stream your podcast, church service, car show, sporting event, your wedding, or even your cannonball attempt, Boxcast is an easy, flexible live streaming platform for organizations and individuals. Boxcast is so easy, we're broadcasting this from a phone. Head over to switchcars.com/boxcast for your free trial. Again, it's switchcars.com/boxcast for your free trial. So let's keep things moving here. 1904, so let's see, Lester Whitman came into the picture, and that will continue to be a familiar
very common name.
Lester Whitman and Clayton S. Karas in a Franklin runabout reset the record by a crazy margin.
They did.
32 days and change. The total run was 785 hours and 20 minutes.
I mean, they knocked 19 days off a run in 1 year's time.
Absolutely. That is fantastic. Not content with that, let's see, in 1906, Lester Whitman, Clayton Karas, plus three quote-unquote relay drivers, about which we have no details,
I have details.
Oh, you do?
I have details.
They reset the record again. So we're at 362 hours. So they almost halved their record again.
They did
in a six-cylinder Franklin.
Did it in 15 days.
15 days. Now, I do want to note, right, so people that say modern cannonballing is dangerous, nothing compared to the early cannonballing.
No.
In 1906, during their record, there were two collisions, and Whitman was also arrested for speeding, and I think a brisk 60 miles an hour.
Yes.
So these early runs were not without their issues. And I think later on, when Lester went to go again in 1910, he was chastised by the manufacturers and basically put on a very short leash and said, hey, you can't,
you got to slow down.
Shenanigans, you got to slow down.
But that 15-day run, they actually had four teams of drivers.
And the car, does this count, or is there an asterisk?
Well, it's a transcontinental crossing, but they had to utilize trains to beat the record.
Okay, so it's the same thing they did in 1910. So that's a strategy they employed multiple times. So was it the same? So were Lester Whitman and Clayton Karas the same? Were they on the run the entire time?
No, they weren't.
But they were there at the start and there at the finish.
Correct.
I mean, so they were consistent. They were drivers throughout.
They were.
But the relay drivers changed.
They did.
So,
and they would stop at a town, and the team that pulled into the town would get out of the car and get on a train. And a team was there waiting for them, and they would get in the car and continue driving. So on the train, they could eat, rest, clean up, wash your face, you know, sleep. And the train would beat them to the next town. And they would get there, and the car would arrive. They would do it again. The car basically ran 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
So it was not the same group of five people start to finish.
Correct.
Some people did not do the entire trip.
There were some legs they did not do.
Okay, I'm disqualifying this run. Sorry. Retroactively, I am. I feel like that is they didn't have rules then.
Right.
It is a transcontinental record, but the rules kind of retroactively applied, and that seemed to be consistent among these older runs, apart from this, is that it's the same car and the same drivers start to finish.
Right.
Nobody quits. Nobody gets back on.
And Lester Whitman did that a couple of times with different drivers that would take over the car. But he is unique, and my studying of the Cannonball history is the only one that ever did that.
So that brings us to the 1910 record, which was the same group. It was Lester Whitman, but this time it was Eugene Hammond, Dave Fassett, C.E. Griffith, and P.J. Haycock.
Mm-hmm.
And they did it in a 1910 Rio 30 in 258 hours. So again, they reset their record. It looks like they reset their own record twice.
They did.
Now, in this instance, they did utilize trains, but it was the same five drivers from start to finish.
Right.
So they would get a rest. They would rotate on the trains, but it was all five of the same drivers all the way. And that presented its own logistical challenge in planning the train schedules and arriving and making sure that everybody was there, which is pretty
incredible. Happens when the car breaks down in between the two train terminals and the other team sitting there expecting the car to arrive and it doesn't show up, and they had to use their technology at the time was telegraph. So the car team would have to ask someone to go to the telegraph office and send a telegram ahead to the next train station to let them know we've broke down. They'd get the car fixed. Send another telegram, says, oh, we're on our way again. You know, it was the text messaging of the time was the telegrams.
That's pretty amazing. So then that brings us, unless you have a side note here you want to pause on. So that brings us to 1915. Now, or actually 1914 is the first known run of Irwin Cannonball Baker. Correct me if I'm wrong on
that. Right.
In a 1914 Indian V-twin motorcycle. Mm-hmm. He did that in 276 hours, which was the fastest motorcycle time at the time, beating Volney Davis's run on an Indian in 1911 at 489 hours. Now, that would be the overall record if we threw out the relay driver run. But I think if it's all the same drivers, as my own committee of, you know, Cannonball certification, according to this podcast for the show, I'm counting the 1910 run. I'm throwing out the 1906 run. But that would have been the overall record, but it was not. He went again in 1915 in a Stutz Bearcat. Both of these are very famous runs, and most people kind of consider Cannonball Baker as the forefather of Cannonball. Most of the press was about him. In fact, one newspaper article on one of his runs described him as driving so fast or crossing the country so fast that it was as if he got shot out of a cannon. And of course, he was an entertainer. He was a marketer, and he seized upon that and immediately trademarked Cannonball as his middle name, as his calling card. So it was actually a trademarked term that he used, and he marketed it heavily. And boy, did it work, because it still is known as Cannonball.
Oh, an interesting bit of history that some people don't mention. Irwin Cannonball Becker was the first manager for NASCAR.
And he was then the commissioner of NASCAR as well.
Yes, a lot of people don't realize that.
So the 1915 run was a solo run, and we believe, is that the first solo run in existence?
Not exactly.
All right, well, tell us about it.
The first solo run in existence actually happened in 1909. And believe it or not, it was done by a woman named Alice Ramsey. Now, she didn't set a record as far as the time, but she was the first female in the state of New York to get issued a driver's license. Now, there were three other people in the car with her, but they didn't know how to drive a car. She drove it the entire way.
She did that in a Maxwell 30 Touring, and she completed it in 59 days.
Yes.
That's pretty impressive. Pretty impressive. Now, there was another female to run in 1916, Amanda Pruess, and she did it in 269 hours, which actually beat Cannonball Becker's time in 1915. But... boy, oh boy, Cannonball Becker did want to set his own record. So also in 1916, he came out with a Cadillac V8 and claimed the new record at 179 hours and 52 minutes. So these times are falling incredibly fast. In 13 years, we went from 51 days to 179 hours.
Yes.
And the best information we have is that was also likely a solo run. Cannonball Becker was a man among men. And most of his feats were by himself, often with a journalist or a mechanic or something like that. But there's no runs that we've come up with where he was listed with a co-driver.
Right.
Now, that may have been just that he had a giant ego and didn't want anyone else to get credit. But
he was trying. Yeah, at the time, he was getting sponsorship offers from everybody. And so, like at this time, you know, he had a previous sponsorship with Studebaker, and Cadillac had built cars with their bigger engines and wanted to prove their reliability and how fast they were, and sought out Cannonball and said, hey, drive our car, do a record. And they hired a journalist to ride along with him. And every stop along the way, in the telegrams, the journalist would write stories and put them out over the telegram to be published in local and regional papers, telling about his exploits. Again, this was all sponsored by Cadillac.
Yep, and Cannonball had a saying that he would get vehicles from these manufacturers, and he said, no record, no money.
Yep.
So if he didn't set some sort of record, and it wasn't all transcontinental records, he did not have to get paid. The early era of transcontinental records was, in a sense, utilized by manufacturers to prove two things. One, the need for transcontinental highways and interstate highways, because the auto manufacturers were petitioning the government because they wanted highways, because then they could sell more cars.
Right.
They didn't want to pay for it. They wanted the government to pay for it.
But everyone
they
was
wanted
petitioned.
To profit off of it.
Yep.
But they also wanted to prove reliability. And so what better than to have a highly publicized, well-known driver take your car across the country, especially without breaking down or doing it faster than anybody else.
Exactly.
So manufacturers were giving cars to drivers left and right to do these runs. And it became pretty competitive in the 1920s. So on August 5th, 1920, two drivers in an Essex then dropped the record. Let's see. It was 179 hours. They dropped it to 110 hours in 43 minutes. And the interesting thing about this record, it was the first transcontinental U.S. mail delivery. So they took a piece of mail.
Yes.
And it was, I think, from one general to another and delivered it across the country. And that was their shtick, their claim to fame. But they also did it incredibly quickly. Celebrity Machines is a proud sponsor of Switchcast. Celebrity Machines offers more than 250 different screen-accurate license plates as they appeared in movies and TV shows like Back to the Future, Ghostbusters, The Fast and the Furious, Breaking Bad, and so many more. Celebrity Machines also makes our dealer insert plates as well as our commemorative 2539 plates from the fastest cannonball run ever. If you're looking for a gift for somebody you like or for garage art for your own place, check out celebritymachines.com for more info and use promo code SWITCHCAST for a 25.39% discount at checkout. Again, go to celebritymachines.com and use discount code SWITCHCAST. 1924, Irwin Cannonball Baker had to come back and reset the record again. So he did it in a Gardner sedan, but he only beat the record by about 30 minutes.
Yes.
110 hours and 15 minutes. Although there's conflicting reports, there is a plaque out there that claims it's 110 hours, 25 minutes. But either way, it is a new record. It was also the first midwinter cannonball. He did
Yes.
He did this in the middle of the winter. And again, that was to prove a marketing point that I think it was about certain type of tires, but also to promote the Gardner Motor Car Company as well. These cars are great in the winter. They can drive in the winter and be perfectly reliable and safe. So that was their claim to fame. Again, there was always something along with these runs to be a marketing shtick.
Talking about sponsorships, Harvey Firestone was a big part of that, and they were testing the technology of their tires.
Mm-hmm.
And he worked with the manufacturers on these runs and got feedback, and he often provided the tires to Cannonball Baker for his runs. So he was sponsored by Firestone, probably one of the first automotive sponsorships, tire sponsorships ever, was Firestone sponsoring Cannonball Baker. Didn't matter what car he was driving in, it had Firestone tires on it.
Wow. That's pretty cool. And they're made right here in Akron, Ohio.
There you go.
Maybe we should get them to sponsor our upcoming documentary, Forget Goodyear.
Yes.
So in the books that I've been reading about these early runs, there's been some really hilarious anecdotes, right? So when we do a run, people ask us about, like, well, bathroom breaks and how do you avoid police and stuff like that. And those questions are great and they're funny, but the questions and the challenges that accompanied these early drivers are completely ridiculous when we look back on it. For example, one obstacle that one team faced, they came up against a road obstruction. So the road was closed, if you could call it a road, that happened to be a team of horses that was struck and killed by lightning.
Yes. Talking about Alice Ramsey. They were on a drive and they were out west and they going down a dusty path. And there were some, well, in her book, she describes them as Indians. So I want to be politically correct. They were Native Americans. Don't offend anyone. Just be careful. They were on horseback and they had their bows and arrows drawn. And they stopped and were scared because they thought they were coming after them and their car. And so when they come to a complete stop, they saw a rabbit run out of the shrubs, and they were simply hunting, and so they got delayed for that, for the hunters hunting this rabbit with their bow and arrows. It's
another great quote from Alice Ramsey's story. She was 22 years old when she did this, by the way. she had trouble finding, they didn't have GPS back there, right? So she had trouble finding a yellow house where the direction she was given called for a left turn.
Yes.
Right? I think she got the triptych from AAA, right?
No.
And so she was flipping pages. I can't find the yellow house. So she stopped in at a farm to inquire about this yellow house, and she was told that the owner of the yellow house was anti, he was totally against cars, and so he had repainted the house green.
Yes.
So he couldn't be used as a landmark.
To confuse people driving by in cars.
So it was the first cannonball protester.
Yes.
another anecdote from I don't remember which book this was from, but it's just a funny quote. It says, for 75 miles, we did not pass a house or rang. When we arrived at Medicine Bow, a husky maiden was ringing the dinner bell, and record or no record, we sat down at a rough plank table and found a dinner fit for a king.
Yes. Just you didn't have diners then. You stopped at people's houses and ate.
I read the husky maiden thing, and all I can think of is the Seinfeld episode where they're taking the bottles and yeah. Newman falls in love with the farmer's daughter.
Truck. Yes.
I'm like, oh gosh. Mm-hmm. Was it the husky maiden or the dinner that they delayed for?
Yeah.
Oh man. And then LHA's Lincoln Highway Association's official guidebook, published in 1915, advised motorists, don't allow the car to be without food of some sort at any time west of Salt Lake City, and don't wear new shoes.
Yeah. So, talking about the clothing they wore like rubber dusters, basically, or oil-soaked leather to protect them from the rain, because these cars weren't enclosed. They were open-top vehicles. They had no roof over them. You know, driving through the mud and the rain, yeah, and the sun coming down on you. You know, we think we got it good on our runs with the cruise control and the air conditioning. Yeah, you had massaging, ventilated, heated seats. And, you know, and they're riding in these oil-soaked canvas outfits with great big hats in the sun. And No, thank you.
What we're doing is child's play.
It is.
So it got real competitive here in the mid-1920s. Enter Lewis Miller and Ab Jenkins in the fray. So 1925, Lewis B. Miller and C.I. Hansen reset the record in a Will St. Clair T6 Roadster, 102 hours and 45 minutes. The following year, June 1926, Ab Jenkins and Ray Peck in a Studebaker Sheriff were the first to break the 100-hour mark at 86 hours and 20 minutes.
And they broke their own record.
Let's see. They did. Lewis Miller came back and did it in 83 hours.
Okay.
Although there's conflicting information in my research. So I have them at 83 hours and 12 minutes, but another source cited 88 hours. In 1926 or 27, we have an unknown driver at 79 hours and 55 minutes. And then Ab Jenkins came back in 27 in a Studebaker Commander at 77 hours and 40 minutes. And we're going to pause on that car for a minute, because that car, that actual car, is still in existence at the Studebaker Museum, and that will be on display in Minerva on September 14th as well.
Huge.
And
piece
the
of history.
Super cool thing about that car is it is still as it finished the race. It is, they hand painted the trip and record statistics on the cars back then. That's, you know, why the modern record holders get a graphic made on their trunk. You know, it's kind of a throwback to that. But this Studebaker has all of the trip details painted all over the car, and they reference this previous record of 79 hours and 55 minutes. And that's literally the only information we've found about that record is from the painted stats on this 1927 Studebaker.
And what you have to, you know, the reason there's so little information, by that point in time, it'd been almost 15 years since Cannonball Baker did his first run, and he'd become such a huge celebrity and had done multiple runs that people were kind of getting tired of it. So the press coverage was starting to die down at this point. And a lot of the details and information is lost.
Yeah. But and even then, it may have been in one or two newspapers, but it's not like we can just search the internet and find it. So trying to come up with this information is very difficult. But even back then, proof was very important part of this.
Yes.
So in May 1916, Robert Hammond claimed to have made the run in 154 hours, which decimated any time at the time, right? I think so. In 1916, Baker's run was, let's see, Baker's run was 179 hours.
Right.
So he's claiming to have gone 25 hours faster than Cannonball Baker. But there was no record of him essentially west of the Mississippi River. So he recorded pulling into New York. No toll receipts,
had
no gas receipts,
he had no
witnesses, nothing. So he claimed this record, but it was a big deal at the time. It was highly controversial, and it was indeed discredited because of a complete lack of evidence, along with a number of claims of his that...
Why does that sound familiar to me?
Well, that's not the first... Well, that was probably the first time it's happened, but it has happened since then as well. But let's see. We are in 1926. Goodness gracious. So many records. They just keep dropping. But tell us... let's pause a little bit. Tell us about Ab Jenkins. He was a force in Cannonball.
He was. Ab Jenkins and Irwin Baker were... fierce competitors against each other. When one would do something in a car, the other one would get mad about it and go and try to beat it. And they went back and forth and back and forth. And there's a famous run that started in 1904. It's called the Mount Washington Hill Climb.
Yep.
Back from your neck of the woods.
From my neighborhood, yep.
Yes, and this was before the Pikes Peak, before the Indy 500. And one year... Irwin Baker won it, and then Ab Jenkins won it again, and then the next year Irwin Baker won it. And there's quite, if you look at the history of the Mount Washington Hill Climb, there's some famous names in there. In the 1950s, one man named Carroll Shelby drove a Ferrari to the top of Mount Washington to set a time record, believe that or not. So there's some good company in these names. They're all
absolutely,
they're all connected and tied together somehow.
Yep.
Some way.
Ab Jenkins was also known for many Utah Salt Flats records.
Yes.
Both Ab Jenkins and Cannonball Baker were avid racers in many different disciplines. We then come from 1927, 77 hours, 40 minutes, to 2014, the Tesla corporate team, 76 hours, 6 minutes. Oh, wait, no, okay, sorry, 1928. Irwin Cannonball Baker comes back.
Yes.
75 hours in another Franklin. There's like four or five different Franklins that set records.
Yes.
They're in there quite a bit. In fact, then he beat his own record again in 1929 in a Franklin 135. We're down to 69 hours, 31 minutes.
And so what year was that again?
That was 1929.
So from 1903 to 1929, we went from
51 days to 69 hours.
69 hours.
We're very close to 50 hours. 1931, Lewis B. Miller comes back into the scene with an unknown co-driver in a Plymouth, 65 hours and 33 minutes. Now, this one is crazy. So this was the first coast-to-coast-to-coast run.
Yes.
So they went out and back. They went from New York to California, set the record of 65 hours and 33 minutes, then turned around and beat their own record back 65 hours and 24 minutes. So they beat their own record by 9 minutes. Ironic, because the coast-to-coast-to-coast record, the modern one,
yes,
was recently beat by nine minutes.
And exactly 7 days apart.
7 days apart. You can't make this stuff up. This is nuts. We love it.
And that's why we study this history. You know, we become fascinated with it and the stories and the background and what we're doing in the modern day runs. I call it the Yates era of runs, or should we call it the Alex Roy Eric's runs? I don't know.
Sure.
But is it any different than what they were doing 100 years ago?
Yeah.
You know, the mentality of it, the effort that they put into it, it hasn't changed.
We're happy to have Nuts for Sticks as a sponsor of Switchcast. Nuts for Sticks is a fantastic merchandise site where you can get t-shirts, car-related t-shirts that usually also have dad jokes and puns on them. They have a great selection of high-quality t-shirts there, so go check them out at nutsforsticks.com and use discount code SWITCHCAST for 10% off your entire order. Again, that's nutsforsticks.com, discount code SWITCHCAST. 1932, Bob McKenzie then does it in 60 hours and 26 minutes. Again, we don't know if he had co-drivers, but he is the driver credited with this new record. And then we have, of course, the end of this era, which was 1933, when Irwin Cannonball Baker came back and set the record at 53 hours and 30 minutes. So 1933, 1903, in 30 years, we go from 51 days to 53 hours.
And that's
an incredible advance both in road technology and vehicle technology.
There's one run that's in there that's not a record. And for me, it stands as the most historically significant transcontinental drive. And it was one that was done in 1919. And it started on the ellipse of the lawn in front of the White House. It was a convoy of 80 U.S. Army vehicles driving to San Francisco.
That was pretty cool. Yes, and there was other interesting things of like families going, and there was actually a luxury trip. We'll get into that. I'll let you finish your story first.
But the reason why, to me, that particular event was historically significant, there was a lieutenant colonel at the time who was West Point graduate, who was signed to be an observer. And he actually showed up a day late. He met the convoy in Maryland, and the first day they only went 8 miles due to mechanical breakdowns, and they were so unorganized. And he helped them, this lieutenant colonel, get reorganized and wrote a diary that run. Well, that lieutenant colonel later went on to become the supreme commander during World War II and then president of the United States. Franklin Roosevelt.
That's pretty incredible.
Excuse me, Dwight D. Eisenhower. Dwight D. Eisenhower. Yeah,
get your president right. Come on.
Wrong president. Dwight D. Eisenhower. And our Eisenhower Federal Interstate Highway System today is directly an outcome of that Army convoy. We wouldn't have it, the roads we have today, if it wasn't for him.
Mm.
So
it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Very cool. I have a footnote here. 1933, Bob McKenzie possibly may have done it in 57 hours and 38 minutes in an Auburn Speedster. We have no confirmation of that, but that's in here. So he may have beat the time before Cannonball Baker then did 53 hours and 30 minutes. But the 53 hour and 30 minute was also a solo run in a Grand Page Model 57 Blue Streak. And as the story goes, he only stopped once for a half hour nap on the whole trip.
Yep.
Now, there's very little information about this run, surprisingly, possibly for the reason you gave, that there are so many records that it's just people stopped writing about it. But also that year, Cannonball Baker did a publicity outing with the Graham Motor Car Company, and he took a Blue Streak sedan, and they were touting their new safety glass, and he did the Graham safety tour. So it may also be that all of a sudden manufacturers were starting to care about public appearances, about liability, about safety and things like that. And this wild west of transcontinental races and records had come to an end. And maybe they said, hey, don't talk about this one.
Or they were protecting the technology. We're going to pull your endorsement. You know, didn't want the competitors to get an edge.
Potentially. But for whatever reason, there is almost no information out there about one of the most significant records in history, because this was the end of what I'll call the Baker era. Mm-hmm. That's all we know. 53 hours and 30 minutes. Now, that was widely held to be the last record until Brock Yates famously went out in tribute to Cannonball Baker to set a new record, and went out with Steve Smith and Brock Yates Jr. in 1971 to reset the record. However, thanks, I believe, mostly to Mason Dibley, we've uncovered a few in between them that are very, very interesting. Before we get to those, I want to share one more anecdote about the early runs that I think is interesting. So there's a couple, there's a book, but a few chapters in a couple different books about some of the early transcontinental records and crossings, not just the records. One of these was a high luxury convoy of some of the richest people in America, and I think that cost them about $10,000 per family to do this run. And they were staying at all the best hotels, had catered meals, had convoys and escorts into the cities, had mayoral greetings, had parades, had all this
had
different
big
stuff.
Bands greeting them
and
dances
I'm reading
every night.
This going, you know, people knock like the Gumball Rally and the Gold Rush Rally for being not in the spirit of Cannonball. But I'm like, wait a minute. They came up with this idea 100 years ago.
Exactly.
They were doing luxury rallies when they really weren't luxury at all. I mean, if you said that you had to take an Ariel Atom on a Gumball Rally and, you know, you couldn't take hot showers and didn't have a cell phone or whatever, and could, you know, didn't have a top, and nobody would do it.
No,
couldn't pay somebody to do that. But that's was the definition of a luxury tour back then, and it was, I think it was months long, and they almost all got arrested in some town in Utah for drinking illegally or some silly thing like that.
Yeah, some of the women wore pants. Oh, my God.
But seriously, the sheriff was looking for them. They had to settle charges later on. A bunch of them had to go back to court and stuff. It was absolutely crazy. But the three records in between, and then we'll wrap it up, and then the next installment of this docu-series, we'll call it, will focus on the Cannonball Run, the multi-car race era of this. But there was three known records in between 1933 and 1971. The first was in 1959, John Penton crossed the country in 52 hours and 11 minutes on a BMW R69 motorcycle.
Yes.
So he was the first one since 1903 to hold the outright transcontinental record on a two-wheeled vehicle.
Correct.
It had all been four-wheeled automobiles between 1903 until 1959.
And what's interesting, that motorcycle, it was actually confiscated from leftover World War II Germany.
That's pretty crazy.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty crazy. In 1965, an unlikely hero, a Sunbeam Imp sports sedan. Look it up. It's this little, I didn't know what this even was until I read this. It's this little tiny British car. It was also made under the Hillman name, and I think Rover as well. Mm-hmm. It was made under like four
Rover
different
engine
names. Yeah. Stanley Rosenthal and Herman Jane, that's odd spelling, did this for a auto magazine, and I don't think they set out to break the record. No. They just did it to do it, but they broke the record, 48 hours and 9 minutes, the first run under 50 hours.
But that's the run that started the gears turning in Brock Yates' head.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. And in the middle of that, one more to touch on, 1934, Bob McKenzie comes back and does it in 49 hours, 37 minutes, which would have been a record. However, he went from Los Angeles to Savannah, Georgia, which cut a couple hundred miles off of the run.
Yes.
So that, I think, is the one that establishes that there was no set route for Cannonball.
No.
But every single record prior to that was New York to L.A. or San Francisco or vice versa.
Right.
And that's kind of set the tradition for the runs both in the 70s and present. It is always New York to California or vice versa. Right. And, of course, in the 70s, they kind of immortalized the Red Ball Garage and the Portofino Hotel. So it went just not just from New York to L.A., but from this point A to point B, the specific ones. And we're fortunate enough to still have those landmarks today, and we can use them as start and yes. end points. But one final run in 1968, Tibor Serosi did it again in a motorcycle and again on a BMW R69. And he did it in 45 hours and 41 minutes.
And the motorcycle record was just recently broken.
32 hours and 32 minutes,
32,
I believe.
32.
That's correct. But this was an overall record. So it's the third time, and I believe the final time, that a motorcycle held the overall transcontinental slash cannonball record. So with that, we'll leave you guys hanging and wait for Brock Yates to enter the picture in 1971 with his famous moon trash van and start an entire new era of Cannonball. Yes. We hope you have enjoyed this history of early transcontinental records. And as much as we've enjoyed learning about it, it's been a lot of me dozing off into old books, trying to keep up with the details to parse out the really interesting
stuff. Should we compile a list of the books that we have put together?
We should.
Because, some of them are rather obscure, like Alice's Drive, the story of Alice Ramsey, and they're available still inexpensively. And a lot of these other books the same way.
Yeah, but not really on Amazon or anything. No. You've had to search them out.
Yes.
I think you wrote to somebody in the mail and sent them cash to get their book, right?
Yes, there was one I had to do that to get.
Yeah. So it's been some fun research and making a lot of friends along the way. And I'm sure there's more information out there, more records that we have not discovered. And we love every new finding. It's like, finding a pot of gold. We're like, all right, we get to add this to a spreadsheet.
I should mention, we have the spreadsheet, but the link to the spreadsheet. And if you stumble across something and compare it to the spreadsheet, and if you see something that's new or something that's incorrect, send it to us. Let us know. We want to keep the information current.
Absolutely. Absolutely. One last note about the 1910 run before we sign off. Not only did they have two collisions, but there was a number of fatalities. We say the Cannonball has a completely clean history, no bad accidents. Well, that's not entirely true. In 1910... a dog, two pigs, a skunk, and 12 chickens were killed.
Yes. Yeah, which is... Yeah.
Sorry, animal lovers.
And talking about speeding tickets, Horatio Nelson Jackson's run, he was from Vermont, and many, many years later, he got his first and only speeding ticket he ever got in his life in the state of Vermont. It was in 1944. Guess what the speeding ticket was for. Guess the speed.
What year?
1944.
50 miles an hour.
6 miles an hour. He got a speeding ticket for traveling 6 miles an hour through the downtown of his community in Vermont.
Well, this
was 1944. Just how did they measure that? I don't know.
Oh, man. I would also say, it's always one more thing, but there's so much good stuff from this. But relating modern cannonballing to the early days is there's a lot of internet commenters. Everybody has an opinion. Everybody has their own rules that they've made up about what's fair and what isn't. But we consistently get people saying that we cheated because we used spotters or countermeasures or extra fuel tanks or any number of things. But even in 1903 to 1906, the runs were all sponsored by these automakers. Nearly all of them were done by professional career race car drivers.
Yep.
And often they were done in highly modified vehicles using larger gas tanks, extra seats, removed fenders, whatever they could do to gain an advantage. Mm-hmm. This was a race, and they were using any possible means to gain an advantage right from day one.
Yep.
That still holds true today.
Mm-hmm.
And I think anything done short of putting your car on a plane or swapping cars or something that's totally outside of the unwritten rule of same car, same driver, start to finish is within the bounds of acceptability.
It is.
And it's about innovation. It's always been about innovation, about solving a challenge. How do we get around obstacles and get there just a little bit faster than the last guy?
Exactly.
So with that, thank you for joining us. We'll move on to our props and flops of the week, just so you guys have a little taste of the usual podcast shenanigans, and we'll see you next week. The props and flops are brought to you by Switch Cars. Switch Cars is the enthusiast dealership where we buy, sell, consign, service, and store only cars that we like ourselves. Well, we'll store anything that pays the bill, except EVs. We're not going to store EVs, and we definitely don't sell them either. Anyway, check out our handpicked inventory at switchcars.com and mention discount code SWITCHCAST for your special pricing. That's right, check out our handpicked inventory at switchcars.com. Our flop of the week. Saratoga Automobile Museum, which is a fantastic museum and has rolling displays similar to the Peterson model, has the 1971 Cannonball-winning Ferrari Daytona on display that set the record and won the 1971 Cannonball piloted by Brock Yates and Dan Gurney. The only problem is their giant display next to the car says that it won and set the record in 1972. That's a big oops to put in print for everybody that's viewing the car at the museum, although I'm sure nobody will know any better except us cannonball nerds. Anyway, I thought that was an appropriate flop for this week's episode, given that we are covering accurate history of cannonball records. Prop of the week. Bring a Trailer is rolling out a new make offer program for only the high bidder on reserve not met auctions. Previously, they had just essentially given the contact information of the high bidder and the seller after the auction if the reserve was not met. Well, now they are using their verified checkout process and have rolled out a best and final offer, which puts a sense of urgency on the buyer and the seller to make a deal. I appreciate this because often when we get a reserve not met scenario, we'll contact the high bidder and we probably have about a 50% chance of closing them. But often they will not even be willing to pay what their high bid was. They try to negotiate down instead of, you know, negotiating up towards an amicable meeting point. So always found that a little bit frustrating. So what this does is the seller has one chance to send them an offer, and the buyer has one chance to send a counter offer, and they each have 24 hours to respond. So they each have to put their best foot forward. They get one shot, 48 hours total, and then everything goes through the BAT system. And of course, Bring a Trailer gets their fee. I'm sure that's why they did this, because not only do they want to track more sales after the fact to add to their growing and giant database of sale records, but they want their fees as well if a sale happens after the fact. So I like it. I think it helps put a sense of urgency on the buyers, so that which the auction does, but they lose that after it's over. So hopefully that will translate to more closed deals for sellers on there. I guess it'll be interesting to see how much the sell-through rate is affected after a while of doing this program. But I like it, and kudos to Bring a Trailer for continually trying to improve. Well, that'll wrap things up for this week, and the next 2 weeks will be part two and part three, the second and third eras of Cannonball, which bring us all the way to present day. So we hope that you will be back and join us for the continuing history of Cannonball.